This podcast contains mature themes and situations. Listener discretion is advised.
Hi, my name is Nathan Lowell. I'm the author of Quartershare and creator of The Golden Age of the Solar Clipper. You can get Quartershare and the other Share novels, along with my newest book, South Coast, as a free audio download from patiobooks.com. And you're listening to episode 14 of Murder at Avedon Hill with P.G. Holyfield.
Welcome to the podcast presentation of Murder at Avedon Hill, The Chronicles of Aramis Cragan, written and produced by P.G. Holyfield. Hey everybody, P.G. Holyfield here. As I said at the end of last episode, episode 13 was part 1 of chapter 13. Episode 14, which you're listening to today, is part 2 of chapter 13. And today's episode, we get to follow Aramis Cragan and Father Joris on their vampire hunt. So, hope you enjoy. As I said also in the last podcast, if you're enjoying the novel, please give the Cairn line a call. That's at 704-315-5884 and leave comments. Or you can go to pgholyfield.com. Click on the Call Me button on the sidebar, put in your phone number, and Grand Central will call your phone, and you can leave comments that way. Again, shorter episode, no story so far. Today, we'll just get into it, and again, I hope you enjoy. See you next time.
See? Arjun guides me.
Aramis had certainly been impressed by the cleric's hunting skills. At times, a bluish halo surrounded Father Joris's holy symbol. At other times, Joris hid the symbol under his robes, as if he believed the creatures they sought would not sense the symbol if covered by cloth. The two men crouched silently in the woods directly southeast of town. A further sign of Joris's ability was the fact that they were downwind of the three creatures they now studied through the branches of the trees. Though their eyes had adjusted to the forest's darkness, Aramis could barely discern any details of the creatures only a stone's throw away from them. The three fed on what was left of several small animals, most likely the remains of rabbits and squirrels. Every so often, one of the things would raise its head and look around, sniffing at the air. But it would throw itself back at feeding, knowing full well that this was a first-come, first-serve meal. Vampire tales were the staple of bards and other storytellers. Aramis loved to listen to stories as much as the next person. He liked to listen for the connections between stories and the Children of Aj, since most tales of the fantastic were usually a result of some past action of one of the children. Once the stench of death surrounding vampires was described, Aramis knew he need not listen any longer. Sure, the smell of sewers and marshes that were home to these creatures could be overwhelming, but soulless, undead creatures such as the vampires before Joris and Aramis produced no inherent odor themselves. Except undead hunters like Father Joris.
Come, monk. Time to send these creatures to the Great Abyss.
A moment later, Aramis found himself crouching alone, the cleric bounding ahead of him towards the vampires. Aramis pulled both of his scythes from his arm sheaths as he ran after the cleric. While initially upset at Joris's apparent disregard for the element of surprise, Aramis soon discovered that Joris truly knew what he was doing. As Joris ran forward, he shouted an Anaran battle cry, holding his holy symbol high. All three vampires turned at the same time, completely shocked by the human's wild approach. As soon as all eyes locked on Joris, he called on his holy symbol's power once again, filling the area with a blue-tinged white light. One of the vampires began turning its head away, while the other two attempted to cover their eyes with arms and with hands still dripping with the gore from the recent kills. But before they could do so, the halo of light became a blast of radiance. The discharge of energy, the white swallowing the blue as it was released from above Joris' head, erupted in all directions. Instinctively, Aramis closed his eyes, even though he knew the light of Arjun would not harm him. The three creatures' attempts to shield their eyes were unsuccessful, to varying degrees. As the blast dissipated, two of the vampires ripped at their now blinded eyes, while the third rolled across the ground, away from the charging cleric, one arm draped across its face. Aramis was amazed by the older man's agility. While time had obviously slowed Father Joris, every step the man took was strong and sure. His white robes billowed behind him as he reached the closest two creatures. With his holy symbol now a bludgeoning weapon, Joris crushed the head of the closest vampire with a single blow, as the first fell upon the remains of its meal. The second relied on its sense of smell to direct its own attack upon Father Joris. As Aramis entered the small clearing, he focused on reaching the third vampire, which had now regained its footing and was shaking its head from side to side. As he charged forward, Aramis inelegantly reached out to enter the mind of the creature. Performing this action while charging into battle was similar to driving a team of horses through the only door of a small shack. Aramis only made the attempt because he had never faced a vampire above ground. The only thoughts Aramis sensed were not thoughts at all. They were the mixed emotions of hunger and fear that threatened to overwhelm him. He slashed down with the sigh in his left hand, a physical cue he used to sever the psychic connection between himself and the vampire. But before the connection was broken, Aramis had successfully discovered two facts. First, that the vampire he chased was stronger and older than the two Father Joris faced, and second, that this vampire had not been blinded. Still, the vampire had been dazed by the light of Joris' holy symbol, and Aramis attempted to take advantage of this, first thrusting the sigh in his left hand, then following with a slash from high to low with the sigh in his right. The vampire used his right arm to block the monk's first blow. The blade grazed its arm, which saved the creature's existence for the short term. It reacted to the wound by jumping back, causing Aramis's second blow to miss its mark. Aramis pressed forward, knowing the longer this lasted, the greater the chance his age would catch up with him. The vampire had retreated 20 paces and took a moment to lick the wound on its arm. The taste of its own blood seemed to renew its strength. Aramis continued forward, but just before he reached the creature, the vampire jumped up and out of reach. Aramis directed the points of his blades above his head, half expecting the creature to fall upon him from above, but instead found the vampire staring back down at him. Light still emanated from Joris's weapon, even as it was being used to pound flesh and bone some distance behind Aramis. The light cast strange moving shadows across the trees, broken by the many branches of the thick wood. Flashes of light that traversed the distance between Joris and the vampire illuminated the monster's face like some demonic perversion of a children's game of hide and seek. But the flickering glare allowed Aramis to process more about the creature's appearance. Mottled skin stretched tightly over a lithe, muscular body, grayish-tinted hide that looked more leather than skin. Its hairless head and sunken cheeks gave the vampire a false appearance of weakness, but its fangs, curved teeth that reached well below its bottom lip, proved to be a great equalizer in that regard. A ragged hiss brought Aramis out of his momentary reverie. It also forced Aramis to recognize that the creature stared down at him upside down like some giant lizard, feet over hands, impossibly gripping the trunk of the giant tree.
"Colin calls for you, soulless one. Do you hear her voice?"
Aramis called upon the name of the destroyer, Colin, who was the child of Aj most likely responsible for the existence of vampires on Cairn. Aramis saw that the vampire understood his words. A smile began to cross Aramis's face as the monster seemed to strain a bit, possibly attempting to listen for the voice of the child of destruction. Aramis brought his left arm down, preparing to throw his sai at the confused monster. Aramis was tossed into the air by a blast that seemed to erupt from the very ground beneath him. The tree that the vampire clung to met an even harsher fate, being completely torn from the ground. While Aramis landed softly a few steps away, the vampire was thrown harshly against the upper branches of a nearby tree and then fell to the ground. Arm bent at an impossible angle, the vampire reached its feet before the monk, hissing in his direction. But then the vampire ran, away from the grove and towards the town of Avedon Hill. Aramis, from his knees, hurled one of his blades at the back of the vampire. The blade only made it a short distance before being knocked from its path by Father Joris's holy symbol. Joris stood, robes bloodied, holding his weapon, breathing heavily. He picked up the sai and walked over to Aramis, helping the monk to his feet.
Sorry about that. I couldn't let you dispatch the leader.
Aramis sheathed both of his blades, looking over at the nearly unrecognizable remains of the two vampires Joris had destroyed. Flesh and bloody gore dripped from Joris's weapon. Joris pulled a great knife from his belt and quickly removed what was left of the heads from the two vampires. He unceremoniously tossed them deeper into the woods.
The leader we follow has come to find the vampire that created it. It will lead us to the vampire, the one that killed Greta Platt. Come!
They rushed after the remaining vampire. Its trail was not hard to follow, even for Aramis. But it was obvious to Aramis that Joris followed more than just a physical trail, as he never slowed for even a moment, running at a pace that threatened to exhaust the younger Aramis Cragan. They approached the edge of the forest, and Joris held up a hand as he slowed. Aramis relaxed his own pace and came to a stop at Joris's side. Through the last trees before them, Aramis saw the main road outside of Avedon Hill, and just beyond that was the great wall that surrounded most of the town. The vampire had led them to the Avedon Hill town gate. Aramis spotted the creature then, leaning against the town wall, feeling its way along the great oak beams. It was working its way towards the gate.
Joris, we have to attack it now.
Father Joris reached out with his left hand and grabbed Aramis's robes.
No, this vampire will find a way in, and we'll be right behind it. It knows its mother or father is here.
But Cletus...
Cletus had allowed them to exit the town after Father Joris told them they were hunting. Cletus had laughed, but seemed used to Joris's requests.
Bring me back something good, Joris.
Cletus will be fine if he stays out of the way. Just watch.
The vampire had found the gate. Instead of trying to force his way through the gate, however, it began climbing the wall. It slithered up a short distance. It then gathered itself and jumped at least two body lengths further up the wall.
In case you wondered if a vampire could have gotten into that courtyard, monk.
The vampire had made it a third of the distance when Aramis spotted a flame near the top of the wall.
What is that?
Flame flickered as it shot down the wall, accompanied by the telltale sound of bowstring vibrations. The arrow embedded itself in the shoulder of the vampire. It scratched at the wall for a moment, lost its purchase, and then fell to the ground. Joris clenched a fist.
No!
Two more arrows were loosed from the bow Aramis now knew was held by Cletus. As Aramis had remembered correctly, there were many places along the top of the town wall that could be manned by archers. The flaming arrows slammed into the vampire's chest. The creature thrashed upon the ground as the flame spread. A last arrow impaled itself through one of the vampire's eyes and through the back of its skull, pinning it to the ground. A few moments later, the vampire's fiery body crumbled in upon itself. It disintegrated before their eyes, leaving only burnt clothing and the four arrows that had caused all the damage. The fire extinguished itself soon thereafter.
Damnable gate man!
Aramis smiled. He was only protecting himself. You cannot be angry at him for that. Joris glared for a moment, but then his face softened.
Yes, of course. But now we have proof. there is a vampire here in Avedon Hill.
Proof? This vampire was only trying to escape us. While fleeing towards civilization does not make sense. It was already injured. Or possibly it sensed a place of refuge beyond these walls. If it had previously lived in the sewers of a city, then instinct might have told it to enter Avedon Hill.
You know nothing of this, Cragen. These vampires were here because they sensed a vampire master. It fled this way, as I knew it would, because it sought the safe embrace of the one who most likely created it. And now...
What, Joris?
Now the proof I wanted you to see is gone.
Joris strode forward, leaving Aramis to follow. Joris refused to speak to Cletus when the gatekeeper let them through the town gate. Aramis remained with Cletus as Father Joris walked off into the darkness without saying goodnight.
I said bring me something good. I'd best be clearer about what I consider good the next time Father Joris goes a-hunting.
You handled yourself well enough. Fire arrows.
I saw your robes earlier today, monk, and I know the types of creatures Father Joris likes to hunt. I wasn't taking any chances tonight.
Aramis bowed his head slightly and wished Cletus a safe night. Later, after Aramis had put away his notebook for the last time that night, he climbed into bed. Aaron, who had remained quiet since Aramis had returned to his room, finally raised his head from his own bed and asked what had happened. After sharing his account of events, Aaron changed the subject and asked, "What does this mean for me? Do I have to endure dreams like this for the rest of my life?" Aramis knew the question would come and was prepared for the answer. "If you are to be a dreamwalker, then that is the will of Aj, Aaron Perti. Your mother has lived with this ability for many years, and without her, you and I would not be here." Aaron only knew a portion of the history between Aramis and Aaron's mother, and Aramis would not tell him more. "That is up to your mother, not me. If you have the ability, you will eventually learn how to control it. There were only a few moments in your dream where you controlled your surroundings, like when you made the torch appear in your hand. In time, you will learn how to control events instead of being controlled by them." "Yes, Aramis."
"So the boy has a gift."
Aramis blinked. Part of him wished he had nodded off, but there was no doubt in Aramis's mind that he was still awake.
"Gareth, I have not seen you in a year, and now you have appeared twice in one day."
"Ari, you've told me before that I'm simply a manifestation of your conscience. Are you feeling guilty about something?"
Aramis pursed his lips and thought. He looked to his left and confirmed that Aaron was snoring in his bed.
Dreamwalking is his family's legacy. I played no part in that.
Gareth nodded, but had a smile on his face.
"Yes, of course, of course. And the rest?"
Aramis was not prepared to discuss the rest. "I made my choice."
"You have made many choices, old friend. One of them has kept me here with you all these years. If I have not earned my place by Az's side, I should be living as a young man somewhere in the world, not here with you."
Aramis waved a hand.
"You probably are. And this is after Aj asked you to join him in his kingdom. I see you laughing at his offer, asking only to be reincarnated as a farmer's son, working a glebe for one of the bishops of the Priests of Cairn."
"Now, why would I do that?"
"So you could one day lead an uprising against your master."
Gareth Becklin laughed.
"Or at least poison the bishop's food. Revenge is Traeg's calling, not mine. Maybe I was born as your prince here. That would be much more poetic."
"Poetry is Balin's calling, not yours. If you were reincarnated, do you think that our connection would allow me to find you?"
Gareth laughed once more, but it was tinged with sadness.
What would you do if you could? Tell me about my past life.
I do not know.
Well, no need for that. I am here because you are an old soul, Aramis. You can believe I am your conscience or your guilt if you like. I know I am here because of our medallion bond and because your powers are that strong.
Gareth paused while Aramis snorted.
Aaron's powers have peeked from under those covers.
He pointed to Aaron's bed.
I hope you both survive long enough to find a use for them.
Aramis looked at Aaron's sleeping form for a moment. When he turned back to respond to Gareth, his old friend was gone.
Something new from audiobooks.com.
South Coast, a shaman's tale from the golden age of the solar clipper. Otto is Richard Krug's only son, an heir to the shaman's gift. The only problem is, Otto doesn't want it. He wants to be a fisherman. But when company policies force unwelcome changes onto his life, and even threaten the security of the village, Otto discovers that being a shaman isn't optional. Jimmy Pirano is caught between the devil and the deep green sea when the new production quotas are handed down from corporate headquarters. Locked into a century of existing practice, Jimmy is forced to find new ways to fish and new places to do it in, or face the very real possibility that Pirano Fisheries will lose the St. Cloud franchise. Join Otto, Richard, and Rachel Krug as they struggle with what it means to be the son of a shaman. Cast off with Jimmy, Tony, and Casey as they navigate the shoals and shallows of corporate fishery along the South Coast. In this fourth novel of the Golden Age, Nathan Lowell weaves together a tapestry of life along the South Coast and explores how business and spirit blend to produce something which might be magic. South Coast, a shaman's tale from the Golden Age of the Solar Clipper. Written and read by Nathan Lowell. Available now at audiobooks.com.
You've been listening to Murder at Avedon Hill, a podcast novel written and produced by P.G. Holyfield. Please visit pgholyfield.com for more information on this novel and the author. Most of the music in this podcast generously provided by Shira Common through Magnatune.com. Magnatune.com, they are not evil. Additional music generously provided by Kevin MacLeod through his website at incompetech.com. Be sure to check out Murder at Avedon Hill at audiobooks.com, and if you are so inclined, please post a review at iTunes, at Podcast Pickle, or at audiobooks.com. Audio comments about the podcast can be left on the Cairn line at 704-315-5884, or go to pgholyfield.com and click on the Call Me button to leave comments. This podcast is copyright 2007-2008 by P.G. Holyfield and is released under a Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivative Works 3.0 U.S. license.